From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And then there is this period when we see a huge, concentrated, wealthy interest force dominating our election process, ruining the potential for any real democracy, taking away any ability for an equal say, political equality in this country.
The Supreme Court struck down white primaries years ago. What about wealth primaries? A new challenge to special interest money in politics. And Peru in turmoil. We go to Lima. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Getting caught with 5 grams of crack cocaine warrants a minimum 5 years in prison by current federal law. To get that much time for powder cocaine, a person would have to be caught with at least 500 grams. Attorney General Janet Reno has recommended narrowing that 100-fold disparity, and in doing so has waded into controversial waters. Critics of the disparity say it's unfair to African Americans, who are more likely to smoke the cheaper crack, which they say is no more powerful a drug than powder cocaine. But others charge crack is far more addictive than powder cocaine and the cause of much more violence among dealers. Janet Reno recommended in a July 3rd letter to President Clinton that the disparity be reduced to a 10-fold difference. This appears to fall somewhere in the middle. In the first evidence of Vatican complicity in the handling of Holocaust money, a document uncovered by researchers points to 200 million Swiss francs, mostly in gold coins, held for members of the Croatian Ustasha after the fall of Nazi Germany. If the 200 million Swiss francs were still held today, it would be valued at about $170 million, plus hundreds of millions more in accumulated interest. Ustashas, who controlled Croatia during the war, exterminated hundreds of thousands of Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies, and historians have denounced the Vatican for maintaining ties to the regime led by Ante Pavelic. A Croatian cardinal was convicted by the post-war government of abetting war crimes. No immediate response to the document's claims was available from the Vatican. The document, disclosed by researchers for an A&E television documentary, is an internal U.S. Treasury Department memo kept secret for 50 years. It's among 15 million U.S. documents related to the safekeeping of Nazi-plundered gold, mostly by Swiss banks. New details of the scandal continue to emerge as various researchers pore over the trove. Hispanic Americans are expected to be the largest minority in the United States within 10 years. A study of Hispanic economic status indicates a third of all Hispanic Americans live in poverty and trail other ethnic groups in educational levels, home ownership, and health insurance protection. The study was released by the annual conference of the National Council of La Raza, the nation's largest Latino advocacy group. Houston Republican Congressmember Tom DeLay could be the next casualty of the foiled coup against House Speaker Newt Gingrich, but not without a fight. GOP dissidents say they were encouraged in their anti-Gingrich scheming by the third-ranking DeLay. DeLay has maintained public silence on the episode. DeLay, along with House Majority Leader Dick Armey, a fellow Texan, and House GOP Conference Chair John Boehner of Ohio, could face a no-confidence votes when Republicans caucus privately tomorrow. A preliminary meeting is planned tonight. The Republican Party received $100,000 donations last month from tobacco giants Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds, which are lobbying for Congress to accept a huge settlement against cigarette makers. A report to the Federal Election Commission shows that each company gave $100,000 in so-called soft money donations in June. Brown & Williamson Tobacco gave $15,000. The report also showed the Republican National Committee returned a $750 donation from a Paraguayan man because of questions about whether he was a U.S. citizen. Foreigners may not donate to U.S. campaigns. The Philip Morris Companies, the nation's largest cigarette maker, paid a small competitor's legal bills for months in an effort to buy its silence about the dangers of smoking. This, according to a lawyer for flight attendants suing the tobacco industry. The lawyer, Stanley Rosenblatt, made the assertion with the jury out of the room in testimony by the owner of the Liggett Group, Bennett Lebo. Philip Morris, he said, didn't pay his bills out of the goodness of their heart. That was a means of buying his silence and cooperation. Lebo's tobacco company, a subsidiary of Brook Group Limited, became the first to break ranks and acknowledge that cigarettes were addictive and cause cancer. Gay and lesbian couples are now permitted to hold commitment or blessing ceremonies in Harvard University's Memorial Church. The decision makes Harvard the second major educational institution after Stanford University in California to give formal permission for gay and lesbian unions in its chapel. In international news, South African President Nelson Mandela met jailed East Timorese rebel leader Xanana Gusmao during his state visit to Indonesia last week. Mandela, who spent 27 years in prison for his opposition to apartheid, requested the meeting with Indonesia's best-known political prisoner during talks with the Indonesian military dictator Suharto. Xanana Gusmao is serving a 20-year term for resisting Indonesia's occupation of East Timor. Indonesia has killed close to a third of the population. That's 200,000 people. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the midst of the campaign finance abuse hearings that are taking place in Washington over these past 2 weeks, more than 150 activists from across the country gathered this past weekend in Raleigh, North Carolina, to talk about the need for what they call clean money campaign reform, or the public financing of local, state, and federal elections. The movement for campaign finance reform has been growing in recent years and is beginning to have some effect. In Vermont last month, the state legislature joined neighboring Maine in calling for the public financing of state election campaigns. The grassroots reform movement has also developed a combative legal wing. Chief in the strategists of this wing is John Boniface. He is the director of the National Voting Rights Institute, which is a public interest litigation and education organization based in Boston, Massachusetts. The institute aims to bring a series of landmark court challenges across the country to the current campaign finance system. I caught up with John Boniface on Friday night, just after midnight, when the first speakers had finished up welcoming the group to Raleigh, North Carolina. And I asked him about the legal movement and how John is challenging the present system.
Well, it's our view that this current system is wholly unconstitutional and that it violates the basic principle of one person, one vote, and needs to be challenged in court throughout this country. We argue that today's wealth primary system, which is effectively the system of raising and spending large sums of money from big money donors, is an exclusionary system and a critical part of the machinery of getting elected. And more than 40 years ago, the United States Supreme Court struck down the last vestiges of the white primary system, a system emanating from the Deep South, which had for years excluded African-American voters and candidates from participating in a part of the machinery of getting elected at that time, the white primary process. And the Supreme Court did something that was very important in those cases. There were four white primary cases that went to the high court.
They were actually called white primaries?
They were white primaries. The state parties may not have called them white primaries, but they became known as the white primary cases. And what happened is the state party primaries often were exclusive only to whites. And then when that was struck down, there was an all-white club in the state of Texas, the Jaybird Democratic Association, which nominated candidates to get on the ballot, excluded African-American voters and candidates, and they were very effective in getting their candidates elected. Almost invariably, if you got the Jaybird Democratic Association's endorsement, you would go on to win the party primary election and win the general election. And in that case, 1 year before the landmark decision of Brown v. Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court said in Terry v. Adams that the Jaybird Democratic Association's private nominating process involved the state. It involved state action. It was part of the machinery of getting elected. And the Equal Protection Clause mandated that it, too, be struck down. We have a new process that tries to cloak itself as a private process today, that tries to say that it is really a process of private actors and has nothing to do with the state, nothing to do with the Constitution, and it's the wealth primary process. It's that process whereby big money donors effectively pre-select the candidates who can go on to win the party primary election and win the general election. And the facts speak for themselves. 89% of House winners who first win the wealth primary go on to win election, 86% of Senate winners first win the wealth primary, go on to win election. If you want to win a House seat, U.S. House of Representatives today, you have to raise and spend over $500,000 on average. If you want to win a Senate seat, you have to raise and spend $4.6 million on average. This system is far and away impossible for ordinary citizens to take part in. And so we are saying that today we need to look at this not only from a practical standpoint of what's wrong, but also from a constitutional standpoint, and recognize that we have a system that has now undermined the basic constitutional rights of non-wealthy voters and candidates. There's a separate line of cases dealing with the poll tax and candidate filing fees that also needs to be challenged, that also needs to be raised here, rather. And that line of cases said very clearly that wealth cannot be a determinant factor in our election process. And so we combine the white primary cases with the wealth discrimination cases in the political process to argue that today's wealth primary is now unconstitutional.
Now, the ACLU takes the opposite line, says it's unconstitutional to limit money that goes into campaigns because money, they say, is equivalent to speech and you can't limit speech.
Right. Do ACLU takes this view, and the Supreme Court has accepted their view that money equals speech for now. And the ACLU helped create that landmark decision in 1976 in which the court equated money with speech and struck down congressional campaign spending limits passed in the wake of the Watergate scandal. But there are really two marks in the ACLU's important history in defense of civil liberties in this country, two very dark periods of the ACLU on issues of our time. One of them was during the McCarthy era, when the ACLU was silent and would not come to the defense of people's lives who were being ruined and careers who were being destroyed. And then there is this period when we see a huge, concentrated, wealthy interest force dominating our election process, ruining the potential for any real democracy, taking away any ability for an equal say, political equality in this country. And where is the ACLU? The ACLU is on the side of the wealthy, on the side of the wealthy interests, on their right to somehow participate in this process in a disproportionate manner up to the sky, spend as much money as they want, no matter what effect it has on the drowning out of the speech of non-wealthy voters and candidates. Non-wealthy voters and candidates, non-wealthy citizens all across this country have speech rights too. And the ACLU is not out there defending their rights. They're out there only defending the purported rights of the wealthy. We argue that the rights that are at stake here are the constitutional rights of all citizens, regardless of their economic status, to participate in this process on an equal and meaningful basis. That's a right which emanates not only from the First Amendment, but also from the Equal Protection Clause. And that right needs to be vigorously defended, and that's what we're doing.
We're talking to John Boniface, who is the director of the National Voting Rights Institute in Boston. One of the cases that you've taken on, John, is the NAACP versus Jones in Los Angeles. Can you explain what this case is about?
Sure. It's the first ever constitutional challenge to the private financing of judicial election campaigns. And judge elections occur in this country in some 39 states. And there's a huge hidden campaign finance problem going on in these election cycles, in which judge candidates are often finding themselves soliciting contributions from lawyers and law firms who have a lot of money to give, and then get elected on with that money, and then these lawyers and law firms appear before them in cases. There is a huge conflict of interest, let alone an equal protection and First Amendment problem. And so we have represented the NAACP and the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, California Public Interest Research Group, and a host of low-income voters in the first direct challenge to this kind of wealth primary system in judge elections. We're suing the state of California. We're demanding that the court mandate a constitutional remedy along the lines of public financing of judge elections in the alternative. And we understand that while Buckley v. Valeo, this landmark decision that the ACLU created, equating money with speech, while that decision stands, that doesn't mean that we can't create alternative public financing systems for both judicial and legislative elections. And we think the courts have a duty to step in and demand that legislatures do that where there's been reticence by the legislature to do it themselves. And so that case is proceeding forward right now on appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The district court erred, we think, very seriously on reading the voting rights law in this area. And we're on appeal, and our argument is August 4th, oral argument before a three-judge panel in Pasadena.
You're doing similar court challenges to what you call the wealth primary system in the Deep South.
Right, we are. We're about to launch two, and I'm not able to talk about the details of those cases until we file them, because we don't want the opposition to quickly learn about them, but they'll learn about them when we file. We're committed to going jurisdiction after jurisdiction in this country with this wealth primary challenge, because somewhere, someplace, there is going to be a recognition by a court, and it might be a judge, and it might be a court itself, that recognizes that there are new constitutional issues at stake here that have not been raised in the past, but now need to be recognized as serious questions. And the fact is that the Supreme Court has ruled in the case dealing with a poll tax, in which a fee was charged to the voter in order to vote and targeted at poor African-American and white voters throughout the South, that poll tax, which existed in this country for decades, eventually was brought down by a U.S. Supreme Court decision. In 1937, a group of poor voters challenged the poll tax as unconstitutional. They said they didn't have the $1.50 it took to pay in order to vote. They went to the Supreme Court. They lost. The Supreme Court said the poll tax was perfectly constitutional. It was fair to ferret out frivolous voters, and it was fair as a means of paying for the cost of running elections. 1951, a group of poor voters went back to the Supreme Court. They lost a second time. Only in the heat of the civil rights movement in 1966 did the Supreme Court finally get it right, when Annie Harper, a poor Virginia voter, and a group of Virginia voters with her, go to the Supreme Court for the third time and challenge a poll tax in Virginia state elections. And it was a $1.50 poll tax. And Annie Harper said, "I don't have a $1.50 to pay." And the Supreme Court said, "You're right. You shouldn't have to pay anything. Not a $1.50, not 75 cents, nothing. The right to vote is for everyone, regardless of their economic status, no matter how poor you might be." And so that decision change forever the landscape with respect to wealth discrimination in the political process. For the first time, the U.S. Supreme Court enunciated the principle that wealth in the political process as a determinant factor has no place. The Supreme Court reiterated that in 1972 in a very different era with a very different court, and Chief Justice Warren Burger, a Nixon appointee, authored the decision striking down a system of high candidate filing fees in the state of Texas. We have today, with this wealth primary system, the newest wealth barrier in the political process. And it too, like the poll tax and candidate filing fee system, is going to be struck down. It may stand today, but the wealth primary is not going to stand forever.
Buckley versus Valeo. Buckley v. Valeo is talked about a lot when people refer to any issue of campaign finance reform. Before you talk about another challenge you have to Buckley v. Valeo in Cincinnati, explain what this case is.
It's a 1976 U.S. Supreme Court decision which equated money with speech for the first time in case law, and said that mandatory congressional campaign spending limits passed in the wake of the Watergate scandal were unconstitutional on First Amendment grounds.
Who's Buckley? Who's Valeo?
Buckley was James Buckley, former U.S. Senator of New York, who wanted to spend up to the sky and wanted to challenge the limits. And he led it along with an eclectic group of people, liberals and conservatives, the ACLU leading the way. And Valeo was the government official being sued in that case at the time. And Buckley does stand as a huge barrier to reform because it boxes us into this notion, this incredible notion, that money equals speech. Money, first of all, does not equal speech. Money is, in fact, a bullhorn to speech. It's a way of amplifying speech. But money itself is not speech. And the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in Buckley got it right and said as much. And Justice White said as much. But the majority of the Supreme Court somehow found that money equaled speech. The second point, though, equally as important, is that even if money equals speech, then what about the speech rights of those who don't have money? They clearly are still protected by the U.S. Constitution, and the Supreme Court left them out in the cold in that case.
John Boniface, he is director of National Voting Rights Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. The number there is 617-867-0740. That's 617-867-0740. We're going to continue our conversation with him when we return in 60 seconds. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with John Boniface, director of the National Voting Rights Institute based in Boston, Massachusetts. I spoke with him on Friday night, the opening session of a weekend strategy session of Public Campaign, which is a new national organization fighting for federal funding of, or state funding of, public funding of, we should say, campaigns around this country. More than 150 activists gathered in Raleigh, North Carolina, to talk about the issue. John Boniface was one of them. And when we finish talking about the issue of campaign finance reform, I'm going to turn also with John to some of the other cases he's taken on, including his suit against Texaco and Unocal, doing work in Ecuador and Burma, respectively. But my last question on the issue of campaign finance reform was around the case of Cincinnati and his being the lead counsel defending spending limits there.
The city of Cincinnati in July 1995 became the first jurisdiction in the country in some 20 years to enact spending limits, mandatory spending limits, for their local election process. And clearly what this is a direct challenge to Buckley. They designed it as such. They knew that Buckley was on the books. But they found that 20 years later, the facts had changed so much so that it was time to revisit that ruling. The city has hired us and retained us as special counsel to defend this ordinance. And we are in the courts with this first direct challenge to Buckley. We've mobilized 24 state attorneys general on our side, 21 secretaries of state, and now the White House and the U.S. Justice Department have announced their likely intention to intervene on our side when we get to the U.S. Supreme Court. We're before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Arguing, in fact, that there are new facts and circumstances in this case that demand that these mandatory spending limits for city council races be upheld. We've seen in the city of Cincinnati races go from costing some $75,000 in 1989 to over $360,000 for certain candidates in 1995. This is an astronomical cost for a city council seat, which pays on average $45,000, $46,000 a year. And so what we see happening at the federal level is happening at the state and local level, and the city of Cincinnati has had the courage to lead the way in challenging Buckley head-on. They have now been joined by the state of Vermont, which passed the second direct challenge to Buckley as part of a whole package, including full public financing on a voluntary level for those who opt in. But if you opt out, you'll be subjected to mandatory spending limits. And so Vermont is now the second jurisdiction in this country to present this kind of test case to Buckley. I think we're going to see in other parts of the country, and I think it's only a matter of time before the Buckley decision is eventually overruled.
John and his father, Cristobal Boniface, have been involved in some very interesting international legal cases, one involving the oil giant Texaco and the other involving the oil giant Unocal. Why don't we start with what's happening with Texaco in Ecuador?
Sure. Well, in November 1993, we filed a class action. We, being my father and I, have a small firm in Amherst, Boston, Massachusetts, and then joined by a law firm in Philadelphia, Cohn, Swift & Graff, filed on behalf of a class of some 30,000 indigenous people and other residents of the Ecuadorian Amazon, a case against Texaco Oil Company in federal court in New York. And this is a case of environmental destruction. Texaco, for 20 years, was the dominant oil force in the Ecuadorian Amazon, exploiting oil from that region and making enormous profit, but also doing it in an entirely reckless manner, in which they effectively dumped millions and millions of gallons of crude oil into the Amazon rainforest and destroyed a whole section of the rainforest and has endangered the lives of tens of thousands of people. And so we believe that Texaco, as a U.S.-based oil company with headquarters in White Plains, New York, needs to be held accountable where it made these decisions to act in this manner. And that is in New York and in the United States. And that it's incumbent upon federal courts of this country to provide that kind of jurisdiction. So we have been battling that question for some 3.5 years, and we're continuing to do that. In November of last year, the third federal judge to preside over this case ruled that Texaco could not be held accountable here in the United States because the Ecuadorian government was not a party to the case, and that the Ecuadorian government could not be a party to the case because of issues of sovereign immunity, that it could not be sued in the United States. The Ecuadorian government, within a matter of days, reversed its position. 3 years it had been on the side of Texaco, demanding that this case move back to Ecuador. But because of the judge's ruling, the Ecuadorian government realized that it was the barrier to holding Texaco accountable for its wrongful action and destructive actions in the Amazon. And so it reversed its decision and came in on the side of the plaintiffs, and in December 96 moved to intervene on our side. And that motion to intervene and an accompanying motion to reconsider is now pending before the federal court, which issued that ruling, and we're waiting for a ruling on that on those motions.
But you've had a little problem since the Ecuadorian government intervened a few months ago on Democracy Now! We had your father, Cristobal Boniface, on, as well as the Attorney General of Ecuador. But the government has fallen. There's a new government there. At least it's been replaced. So where do they stand now? Is the Ecuadorian government continuing to join in the suit against Texaco?
The Ecuador government is continuing to join, and there was an important moment in this case in April this year when the federal court issued an order asking for the Ecuadorian government to reaffirm its position given the change of government, and asked the Ecuadorian government to come back to the court by April 30th at a 30-day window to reaffirm its position. And it did so, and it filed the papers in accordance with the court order. And that now is the basis for what's before the court in terms of the motion to reconsider and the motion to intervene. The important question here, Amy, is a question of accountability for U.S. multinationals as they operate abroad. We have a growing global economy. We have a growing global marketplace. We have NAFTA and GATT and all these trade agreements that open up the doors for U.S. multinationals to go and exploit natural resources and cheap labor from all around the world. And as philosophically opposed as I might be to those agreements, the fact is that the U.S. multinationals now need to be challenged on the question of their responsibility on a global basis for what they do. Not only a global environment, but global human rights, and recognize that if they're going to be opened up to have this kind of marketplace free to go abroad and do what they want, they need to be held accountable for wrongful actions, not only violations of international law, but U.S. law. Texaco got away with reckless behavior in the Amazon of Ecuador, and they need to be held accountable for that reckless behavior in the United States.
John Boniface is our guest, and he is taking on two oil behemoths. He's taking on Texaco in Ecuador, and also Unocal, a Los Angeles-based oil giant in Burma. Tell us about the Unocal case.
I should say that we obviously have a team of lawyers taking on both of these, along with key supportive people who are part of these cases. The Unocal case is another example of a U.S. oil company ignoring the basic rights of people from other lands in order to make a profit and trying to get away without any liability. And they're having a difficult time at this point. Unocal is building a gigantic natural gas pipeline from the Andaman Sea, where they've discovered natural gas, through Burma into Thailand, where they're going to market it for the tune of $1.2 trillion over the next 30 years. This is a very lucrative project for the Unocal oil company, natural gas company based out in Los Angeles, California. The problem is, of course, that in order to build this pipeline through Burma, they have contracted in a joint venture project with the brutal Burmese military regime. And the Burmese military regime is, in fact, the force that is providing security for that pipeline. And what does that mean? That means that villagers are being wholesale removed from their villages. Their homes are being destroyed. They're being forced into forced labor camps and situations to do work that's related to the pipeline. There is enormous accounts of torture and rape and destruction of villages from the pipeline region. All of this occurring in what was previously a remote region of Burma, where there wasn't even a huge presence of the SLORC, the military government and its soldiers. But battalions have moved into this region since the start of the Unocal project. And so we're saying that Unocal needs to be held accountable for its participation in this joint venture project. It needs to be held accountable for decisions that it made in Los Angeles to contract with one of the worst military regimes on the face of the earth.
What is Unocal's response? Where has this gone in court?
Well, I should say that we represent Burma's government in exile, which include elected members of the parliament who were thrown out of the country or placed in prison and in many places killed for getting elected in a freely, you know, run democracy effort and movement. And those people now have set up a government in exile, much like the Polish government in exile prior to Solidarity and the ANC. And they are the chief plaintiff, along with the Federation of Trade Unions of Burma and individual refugees from the Burmese pipeline region who are now living in Thailand. These entities, government in exile, the Burma's Federation of Trade Unions of Burma, and these individual villagers have filed suit in federal court in Los Angeles. And the federal court there has issued an important ruling in a related case brought on behalf of other villagers from the pipeline region. And we are now waiting for a decision in this case. And that decision that the court issued, and the court has both cases before it, was essentially that the jurisdiction would be allowed over Unocal and that Unocal could be very well held accountable for its actions with respect to this joint venture project. After that ruling, the district court decided to ask the United States State Department, prior to issue a ruling in our case, for an opinion as to whether or not these cases impacted in any way U.S. foreign policy. And on July 9th, the U.S. State Department issued an opinion to the federal district court announcing that not only did it not interfere with U.S. foreign policy, but that these two cases would have no impact on foreign policy. And in fact, U.S. State Department's policy towards Burma, as we know, is sanctions for any new investment. Unocal has had ongoing investments, so they're not covered by the sanctions. But the fact is they don't impact U.S. foreign policy, and so these cases can move forward without U.S. State Department resistance.
In fact, didn't Unocal help shape this legislation to ensure that they would not be touched by it by saying that no new investment, meaning no competition, could come in for them, but they could remain there?
Right, and we have no doubt that they attempted to influence the U.S. State Department's opinion in this case, but they did not succeed. So UNICAL has taken the newest tech that is most incredible now, which is they're attempting to move their operations outside the United States. They relocated their president to Asia, to Bangkok. They're attempting to say that essentially this is no longer an American company, but it's a global company. And they're attempting to say that really all this is happening outside the United States.
The president of UNICAL has moved out of the United States to Thailand?
The CEO has remained. Roger Beach has remained the chairman of the board, but the president, John Emily, has left and gone to Bangkok, according to news reports.
Can't that, like, 200-year-old law in the United States, the Alien Tort Claims Act, be used against companies like these? I think it was originally set up to go after piracy on the high seas, and it says they don't have to be in the United States, or at least an individual doesn't. It's how they've gone after foreign dictators. But anyone can sue on U.S. soil someone for crimes against humanity.
Absolutely, and that is, in fact, one of the claims in both of these cases. And the Alien Tort Claims Act needs to be used to bring home accountability to these companies that are violating basic human rights of people abroad. UNICAL is vulnerable, very vulnerable in this situation. Not only vulnerable because politically they've lined up with this brutal military regime, but they are vulnerable because, unfortunately for them, they're before a federal judge who is, at least to date, not willing to buy their arguments that somehow they shouldn't be held accountable. This newest argument that they're somehow no longer a U.S. company is going to be an interesting one, but frankly, I don't think it's going anywhere. It's clear that UNICAL has its headquarters in Los Angeles. It's clear that its headquarters has a role in this incredibly lucrative project that's going to net $1.2 trillion. And so our ultimate point here is where decisions are made to control operations abroad means that that place is the home for accountability as well.
Do you see any connection between these cases, the cases you've taken on with your father, and the campaign finance reform cases that you take on as director of the National Voting Rights Institute, John Boniface?
I think they're entirely related because I think ultimately it is about democracy. It's about, in the case of campaign finance, whether or not we're going to allow concentrated wealthy interests to control our elections or whether all of us as a people are going to control our election process and truly have free and fair elections, have a democracy. With respect to U.S. multinationals and their wrongful actions abroad, democracy requires that they be held accountable where they're headquartered, where those wrongful decisions emanated. And in this case, that's in the United States. And so if we're really true to ourselves about our own laws and upholding our own laws, then we should hold U.S. multinationals accountable not only for their wrongful actions in the United States, but also abroad. And that the power of concentrated wealth needs to be reined in. We're not saying necessarily that oil exploration should not occur at all. We recognize that oil exploration has to occur at some level. But certain places, it might not be able to occur. And even if it does occur, it has to be done in a sound and environmentally protective manner. And if it can't be done that way, it shouldn't be done at all. What Texaco did in the Amazon was it drilled for oil. And when it drilled for oil 8,000 feet down, as any oil company does, it also brought up unmarketable crude oil and waste water, toxic waste water. And throughout the Western world where Texaco drills for oil, it is well known within the industry that when you drill 8,000 feet down and you bring up that toxic waste water and the unmarketable crude oil, you have to re-inject that back into the ground. But in the remote region of the Ecuador and Amazon with poor, voiceless people, Texaco figured they could get away, make much more of a profit, and get away with murder. And so what do? They essentially dumped that toxic wastewater and unmarketable crude oil into unlined, human-made pits that they have scattered throughout the region, over 300 of these throughout the region of the Amazon. This is outrageous behavior. This is not behavior that is acceptable by any human standard, by any international standard, by any U.S. standard. People in the Amazon from the region where Texaco drilled for oil are breathing, living, and eating oil, and it is outrageous. And so Texaco needs to be held accountable for those kinds of actions if we're going to be a true democracy. Unocal also has to be held accountable because we cannot allow companies to go abroad and line themselves up with thug regimes to make a profit off of the violation, the basic violations of people's human rights. If Unocal cannot engage with the mafia in California to make a profit, why should it be able to engage with the Burmese military regime, which is an outlawed nation and which should not be existing because there is a truly democratic government ready to take power and has been ready for years?
John Boniface, will leave our listeners to think about that question. John Boniface, director of the National Voting Rights Institute. If people want to get in touch with you, either on the campaign finance reform cases that you're taking on, or on the issue of Texaco and Unocal and Burma and Ecuador, where can they call?
Well, there are two separate numbers. For the National Voting Rights Institute and for our work in the campaign finance litigation field, it's 617-867-0740.
One more time.
617-867-0740.
John Boniface is director of the National Voting Rights Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. I spoke to him this weekend in Raleigh, North Carolina, where he gathered with more than 150 other grassroots activists around the issue of campaign finance reform and public funding of elections to take special interest money out of campaigns. And we are offering you the chance to push for taking special interest money out of politics in this country. Don't forget, we are still offering our Mug with a Message campaign. You can call our 800 number either to get a cassette copy of today's show or to order our Democracy Now! Mug to be sent to the White House. It says Democracy Now! On one side and Dear President Clinton, Coffee, Tea, and Me. And enclosed with it is a personalized letter to the president from you that says, I heard you've invited big donors, corporate executives, bankers, and arms merchants to have coffee and conversation with you at the White House. It goes on to say, I welcome the equal opportunity to share my thoughts with you in person, Coffee, Tea, and Me, and it is signed by you with your address so that President Clinton can send that invitation to you for coffee at the White House. If you want to send that mug, you can call our 800 number at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also get a mug with a message for yourself. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Just 3 short months ago, Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori was hailed around the world for his attack on the Japanese embassy residence that ended a long hostage crisis, but also ended with the execution of all of the MRTA rebels there. Now Fujimori's popularity has hit rock bottom. His government is falling apart. Strikes and protests have hit the capital, Lima, and the foreign minister, the defense minister, and the justice minister have all resigned. This amidst allegations and revelations that Fujimori has been spying on leading journalists, business executives, and politicians. We go now down to Lima to speak with opposition Congressmember Javier Diaz-Canseco. Can you tell us what is happening there?
I'd say that Peru is living one of the worst, if not the worst, crisis that Fujimori's regime has faced in the last years. On one hand, there's an accumulated frustration of the Peruvian people because Fujimori's electoral offers to be reelected have not been achieved. He offered to reactivate economy and better what were terrible situations in unemployment and subemployment. 85% of the population is subemployed or unemployed, and the minimum salary for a month is $114. So this situation was supposed to change after Fujimori's re-election, and the state was supposed to promote a reactivation of economy. This didn't occur, and this has provoked a enormous frustration in the population, which has been growing since 1995 and is finally exploding in 1997. On the other hand, the crisis deals with civil rights and human rights problems. It has been discovered in the last weeks and months that Fujimori's regime works with quite questionable methods. That is, that Fujimori's dealing with telephone taping of conversations of members of the political opposition, of ministers of his own government, and even of members of the armed forces and obviously journalists of different mass media. And this has also gone hand in hand with the public crisis that is opened in the Army Intelligence Service around the fact that two members of the Intelligence Service have been tortured, one of them, and the other one killed, in the installations of the Intelligence Service on the underground of the office of the Commander-in-Chief of the Army, General Hermosa Rios. The fact that one of these agents, a woman called Leonor La Rosa, has publicly stated and proved that she was tortured inside the intelligence service units has promoted a great political scandal in the government. And this finally has promoted a national antipathy to one of the most important assistants of Mr. Fujimori, who really co-governs with him. I'm speaking about retired Captain Vladimiro Montesinos, a very obscure and questioned lawyer who is the most important assistant of Mr. Fujimori and really sort of a Rasputin of Peru. All this has driven the situation towards national mobilizations and protests against the government. Last Friday, there was a very large popular mobilization, I'd say not less than 25,000 people, which overwhelmed the police and took possession of the Central Plaza in front of the government palace of what you could say is Peru's White House. On the other hand, there's a very intense activity dealing with a recollection of firms, of signatures of the people for a national referendum to discuss if the law that permits Fujimori's new re-election on the year 2000 should be maintained or should be banished. This is basically what is now happening, and this has driven to a situation in which the government has recently changed 5 ministers of state, but most of the people think that this will not change things because power is not really in the cabinet, but in the alliance of Fujimori, Vladimiro Montesinos, which controls the intelligence services, and the general Nicolás de Bari Hermosa Ríos, who is the commander-in-chief of the army. The recent polls, which have been presented by mass media this weekend, say that Fujimori's support in the population is now down to 17.5%, with an opposition or disapproval that is over 75% of the population.
We're talking to opposition Congress member Javier Diaz-Canseco in Lima, Peru, describing the situation in Peru right now. I know after the raid on the Japanese ambassador's residence, when all of the MRTA rebels were executed by the Fujimori military forces, you had said that Vladimiro Montesinos was there walking through the rubble. Can you talk about his connection to the U.S. government, the U.S. CIA, if he has one?
Well, Montesinos left the army during the former military government Peru had at the end of the 60s and during the 70s. He was forced to leave the army under the accusation of treason. He was accused of several charges, but one of them was selling military secrets of Soviet armaments bought by the Peruvian army to the Soviet Union, which was sold to the CIA. He suffered 1 year of prison in the armed forces jails, and finally he was let free after this year. He was sentenced for abandoning his destiny, but his links to the CIA are quite well known. I understand that some U.S. NGOs and journalists have demanded the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense, and the CIA information on the relationship between USA agencies and USA Army and Vladimiro Montesinos. But the answer has been that most of the information is classified and that they are not authorized to inform. Fujimori has a great confidence in Vladimiro Montesinos, and it is obvious that he has quite a strong relationship with some U.S. agencies, even though it seems that other agencies, like the Drug Enforcement Agency, has a lot of questions on Montesinos' role and his links with drug traffickers. It is known that Montesinos has been a lawyer of drug traffickers before being the right-hand assistant of Mr. Fujimori. So there's a lot of questions that I believe some agencies, like the Drug Enforcement Agency, has on Montesinos.
Congressmember Javier Diaz-Canseco, you yourself have been targeted by the Peruvian regime, is that right?
To put simply two examples, in November 1990, I was a member of the Peruvian Senate, and I was president of the commission that investigated telephone taping by the intelligence service. We proved this taping of members of the political opposition, congressmen, members of the cabinet and journalists and trade union leaders. And because of this, the head of the intelligence service had to be removed. But before they did this, they dynamited the front of my house with my family inside. We were lucky and nobody was hurt, but the house was destroyed in all its front part. And in the last month, in March 19th of this year, my car was assaulted, and by around nine persons with bulletproof jackets with the letters of the police, with rifles and machine guns, and the members of the car were kidnapped after shooting my bodyguard. They were asked about their names, their addresses, the number of children they had, and after 1 hour of interrogation, they were let free, but the assaultants took the car, and they burnt it 2 years after, two days after the assault, which is obviously a conduct that no common burglar would do. Nobody assaults a car to burn it if it doesn't have political intentions. So it's been a critical situation during this government with members of the opposition, and my own situation is quite a clear example of the dangers that opposing an authoritarian government could imply for somebody.
Are you concerned about speaking out now, or do you feel that things are changing?
The regime is reacting quite violently against opposition press and against opposition members of the Congress. As you probably well know, the owner of a TV channel that presented publicly the testimony of the intelligence service agent that was tortured. The government has given a resolution that takes away his Peruvian nationality and is trying to throw him out of the control of the TV station. But I also think that things are changing. Are changing basically because people are changing their attitude towards Fujimori, and the opposition to his regime and his authoritarian rule is growing. There's been a recent resolution voted unanimously in the European Parliament, which condemns the violations of civil and human rights in Peru by Fujimori's government, demands respect to the political opposition, to press liberty, and demands profound changes in the penitentiary conditions, and demands also independence of the judiciary, which is absolutely under the control of Fujimori's regime. And the United States government and Congress are also changing their points of view and condemning several violations of civil and human rights.
Do you think he should step down?
Fujimori is involved in a sort of a Watergate scandal through this telephone's taping, which has been made public in 1990 and now again in 1997. And I believe that conditions for Fujimori opening a way for changes in Peru, permitting a reinstallation of a real democratic government, could be a possibility of solution of a crisis which is deepening day by day in the country.
Javier Diaz-Canseco, opposition Peruvian congressmember with the United Left Bloc, speaking to us from Lima, Peru. In this update, we reported several months ago that the two dozen miners who dug the tunnels under the Japanese ambassador's residence for the Peruvian military raid were missing. Well, they still have not been found. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. It's also the number to call to order a mug with a message to the White House or for yourself. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Fuff Vollmeyer. Andy York is our engineer. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!